Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us for today's show. On the episode today, we've got Ben Foulkes, the longtime MMA journalist. He's been covering the sport since 2006. He's written in publications such as USA Today, MMA Junkie, Sports Illustrated, MMAfighting.com, and now he is with The Athletic. He's also a co-host of a very well-done podcast, the Co-Main Event Podcast with Chad Dundas. We talk a little bit about that, but today we are talking about Ben's perspective on Strikeforce Carano versus Cyborg. Ben wrote a retrospective article on that really important event 4 or 5 years ago, and so we talk about his perspective and what that event, what that fight itself meant to the sport of MMA, women's MMA, of course, but we really break it down. It's really good stuff, so hope that you enjoy. Ben's such a smart guy, and we have a great time chatting, so hope that you enjoy it. Without further ado, let's get to it. All right, on the line with us, we have Ben Foulkes. He's been covering MMA since 2006 for outlets such as USA Today, MMA Junkie, Sports Illustrated, MMAfighting.com, and now he is with The Athletic. Always, to me, one of the smartest journalists in MMA. I've been reading his stuff for a long time. Very keen wit, always a strong point of view, very intelligent. In addition to his writing exploits, he also co-hosts the Co-Main Event Podcast with Chad Dundas, who's another one of my favorites, and whose book, Champion of the World, I recently bought at a dollar store. So exciting stuff there. But welcome to the show, Ben. Appreciate you taking the time to be on.
Yeah, my pleasure. I really enjoy picturing the look on Chad's face when he hears that you found it in a dollar store. Was it actually a dollar?
It was a dollar. And I tweeted that to him, and he thanked me and retweeted it. So yeah, it's sitting on my nightstand and it'll get read one of these days, but
it's a really good novel, especially, I mean, I know you're a pro wrestling fan. Anybody who's a pro wrestling fan will really enjoy that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I recommend it.
I wasn't sure that I was going to be into it, and that, cause it's a historical novel. I don't read a lot of novels, but when I started reading, I was like, oh, yep, this is me. I definitely am going to read this. So, yeah, I mean, hey, he got his money at the front end, I'm sure. So I think he's probably okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah. He's doing right.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyways, thanks again for joining us. So I brought you on because you wrote an article about 4 years ago, or I guess 3.5 years ago, for MMA Junkie /USA Today. And it was an historical look back at Strikeforce Carano versus Cyborg. And so I wanted to get you on the show to get your point of view on such, you know, such a historic milestone event. And so let's dive into that. But it marked that event itself, that fight marked the first time in history that two women were headlining a major MMA event. So obviously a big deal. Women headlining an MMA event today is not considered, you know, really a milestone moment anymore. You know, they don't get as much attention as the men do still, but there's been a lot of progress in that. But back in 2009, what did this mean to women's MMA and the sport as a whole?
Yeah, well, you know, Scott Coker and Strikeforce over there in California were sort of early adopters, at least in that part of the country, of women's MMA. You know, Hook and Shoot had been a big proponent of women's MMA and featured women's MMA bouts a lot. But then, you know, Strikeforce was one of the first, like, bigger shows to really make a go of it. Elite XC had put a lot of effort into Gina Carano and to really making her one of the centerpieces, you know, to the point at times it seemed even of heaping a little bit too much on her shoulders. At times, like, just if they were going to have a big show beyond CBS, be something, put something out there on TV, they wanted to make sure Gina Carano was a part of it, whether she was exactly ready for it or not. And when Strikeforce really started to build this thing, Gina Carano and Chris Cyborg were both those two figures where it seemed like everybody wants to see that fight. It's the natural fight to make, but are they going to be able to make it? And one of the things that I remember about working on this story was talking to Gina Carano about it. And at least from her perspective, she said, you know, MMA always, and fight sports in general, they always have those fights where it seems like these two people should absolutely fight. But if they don't have to, if it's a dangerous fight for either one of them, they have other options. Sometimes it doesn't get put together, or it doesn't get put together until years too late. And she said that she didn't want this to be one of those. So when there was the opportunity to make this fight, which she knew, like, it's going to get a lot of attention. A lot of the people who don't normally pay attention to MMA in general, or women's MMA more specifically, they will hear about this one and they will tune in. And she kind of felt like she owed it to the fight world to make this happen, to make this not be one of those that gets away.
Yeah, I mean, you could see that the build was coming, but and to be fair, you know, the motivations for Gary Shaw and company promoting Gina, I mean, her looks obviously, you know, enter into that. However, they do deserve credit for promoting the women. And you got to say that Coker and company kind of stood on their shoulders and built off of what they had already begun to build. So I think they should get some credit for it, whether their motivation was, you know, as pure as, you know, we would like it to be. But, you know, Gina was 7-0, Cyborg was 7-1, you know, building up as stars, but not true superstars. So kind of give us an idea of where they were at in their careers beyond just their record, as far as name recognition and where they are on the, you know, the spectrum of, you know, starting out to superstar, kind of where were they at in their careers at that point?
Yeah. Gina Carano had really gotten noticed outside of MMA already at this point, because she came up through Elite XC, where, you know, she fought for Strikeforce back in 2006 and then became really a focal point for Elite XC kind of 2007 and 2008. She around that same time also was a crush on the American Gladiators reboot that they were doing for a while. Oh, she would show up as like video game characters and things like that. She was kind of the model for, and so you could see people are starting to notice her, and that there other opportunities are starting to come for her. And that was one of the things that I think made it seem like maybe there was a risk that the fight wouldn't happen, even though it seemed like the logical one to make, because, you know, even back then, it was no surprise to anybody that Cyborg was scary. You know, Cyborg, she was still relatively early on in her career, but when she went out there and got going, she put a hurting on people. And people saw that, just that raw power and that ferocity that she brought. And they kind of wondered, well, is anybody going to risk the meal ticket, Gina Carano, by putting her in there? And a lot of promoters, I think, probably would have tried to avoid it, at least tried to avoid it for longer than Strikeforce did.
At least waited, yeah.
But I don't know, maybe there was a sense that Gina Carano, one way or another, won't be long for this sport, that some other entertainment aspect of the world will come knocking and offer her a paycheck that doesn't involve getting punched in the face. And just typically, we've seen that with a lot of fighters in MMA and boxing, when they get presented with opportunities to make a living that's a little easier and a little more lucrative, they often tend to go for it, at least try it out for a while. Right. And so I think that contributed to a feeling of, if you're going to make it, maybe you better go ahead and make it now rather than trying a slow build that never gets anywhere.
Yeah. And we'll get there. But in your article, you'd mentioned that, you know, it was just a couple of days later, after the fight, Gina was getting calls from, you know, from an agent, you know, for a movie that she ended up making. So that tends to make sense that there was already starting to be doors that were opening there. So, but with the demise of, you know, you have the IFL Elite XC Affliction closed out just a couple weeks before Carano versus Cyborg. In fact, one or two of the fights or fighters got moved over to the Strikeforce event. So there seemed to be a golden opportunity for Coker and Strikeforce to capitalize and become a true competitor with UFC, with, if this event draws the eyeballs, if they deliver inside the cage with an exciting fight, that this could be a differentiator for their product. Because at that point, a lot of people may not remember, but Dana White had said he would never, ever do women's MMA. So this was an opportunity for Coker and company, and I think that they saw. With that in mind, you know, was there ever a real possibility that Strikeforce could rise to the level of being a true competitor? Did they rise? The finances, when I see the gates and the you know, pay-per-view numbers and the ratings and stuff, it just seems to be not even close. I mean, UFC was drawing multi-million dollar gates. This event drew, I think it was $737,000. So it doesn't seem like there was competition there, but with this, was that ever a real possibility?
I don't know, especially because in 2009, even more so than now, the UFC was the sport in a lot of people's minds. There were a lot of people who had heard of the UFC, but had never heard of the term MMA.
Right.
They, you know, when I was going around as a journalist back then, if you were talking to somebody on a plane and they're asking what you did,
you say UFC first. Being a publicist at that time, I always had to say, you know, UFC, cage fighting, MMA. I always would go in that order because they got it with UFC usually.
Right. Yeah. And if you say MMA, they give you that blank look and you have to say UFC, and then like, okay, that's what they think of as the name of the sport.
Did you ever go with human cockfighting?
Maybe if I had a couple few drinks or something, I might tell you that. Yeah. I read about the human cockfighting.
Thank you, John McCain. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. But I mean, That was an argument that the UFC used to make all the time when somebody would say to Dana White, oh, we hear that this sport is really growing rapidly and becoming very successful. And he would say, no, the UFC is becoming very successful. Right. The UFC is growing rapidly and we are leading the sport and everybody else is just sort of swimming in our wake. And Strikeforce had been around long enough and a player long enough that it's not like you could say, okay, yeah, they just jump in here and try to make a quick buck. But it also seemed like even if you're in second place at the time, there's a huge gap between first and second. It's not like you're exactly nipping at the heels right there. Like the best you can kind of hope to offer was, okay, the UFC can only sign so many TV rights deals. If you want to get in on this MMA stuff and you have a TV network, you know, you need to come holler at Strikeforce. You need to come talk to somebody else who can give you a good product. And to their credit, I mean, Scott Coker, much as the way he has done kind of with Bellator now, but he would find ways to, like you said, to sort of look and see what niches isn't the UFC filling? What isn't it offering fans that they might like to see? If you can't offer them a better version or like a more prestigious or sought after version of what the UFC is doing, try to offer a different one that does something else. And this was a good example of that.
Yeah. I mean, like the bottom line is, and we've seen it in pro wrestling that, you know, the Monday Night Wars and all of that stuff, that it's great for competition is great for the business of whatever it is overall. But when it comes down to it, if the marketplace is big enough, you can have more than one option. You can have one dominant option. I mean, we're seeing that with WWE and AEW and some of the other players now. There's enough to support everybody, but in the end, there's going to be one true market leader. And it's not necessarily you're trying to topple them, but you know, it's just trying to play within that same pool and survive and thrive and do well. So it's, you know, we talk about it on the podcast. It's like, you know, oh yeah, Strikeforce was a competitor and that's brought up, but I just, the numbers don't really seem to match that up, but that's not necessarily the point of it either. So anyway, so that I appreciate your perspective on that, makes sense, but let's get back to the fight. So to me, this is just me, but watching these events sequentially, and we watched Shamrock versus Diaz, which was the first Strikeforce event after they acquired the Elite XC assets. And they showed, especially during the Cyborg Hitomi Akano fight, they showed Chrono on camera. I mean, it just seemed like every 5 seconds she was on camera, to the point it was getting like voyeuristic and kind of uncomfortable. I mean, she would smile. And again, in your article, I saw like kind of a little bit of a nod to this, that she seemed kind of uncomfortable by it, but, you know, would smile and kind of wave and all that. But to me, the difference between the look in her face before the fight and then after Cyborg just destroyed Akano, to me, there seemed to be a marked difference. And I thought she actually looked a little bit rattled, just seeing that just absolute destruction in front of her. In your mind, was it a mental battle that was lost even before she got in the cage? Did she ever really have a chance against Cyborg? What are your thoughts on that?
I think she would even tell you that it was a mental battle that she lost before the fight started. And she mentioned that when I interviewed her for the story, that there was a feeling of, this is a different sort of fight than the other fights that I've done. And she felt like her body was reacting differently to the moment. You know, you're in that spotlight. It's not just that the opponent is scary, although I'm sure that's part of it, but that there's a very real sense that, okay, you are the star of the show now and everybody is looking to you. And this is going to be the moment that everybody remembers, is how this one goes. And she sort of described feeling outside of herself, like she was not really conscious of making decisions as the fight started and as it was going on. She was just sort of wowed by that, the enormity of the moment. And she said that at one point that, you know, Cyborg ended up on the ground and she looked down and saw herself, you know, briefly on top of Cyborg, and feeling like, whoa, how did I do that? I don't really remember how we got here. And everything was just sort of happening to her, and that she was not really actively making decisions in the fight. And that, I think anybody who's been in some kind of athletics could kind of relate to that. When you get in those times where you just feel like you are completely blown away by the moment and like you're not totally in control of your own body and you're sort of looking down on yourself from above. And I think that's kind of what she described going through. And tough to beat anybody, tough to win a cage fight that way. Really tough to beat Chris Cyborg if you're experiencing that, and she's not.
Yeah, it was Yeah, it's exactly. Basically, I just don't think she really was in the fight to begin with, and just seemed overwhelmed by the moment, and that seemed to be backed up by what happened. But I mean, it did deliver. The fight did deliver from a an optic standpoint. I mean, it was a very exciting fight. I was there, you know, live in person. The crowd was electric. It did, for Strikeforce's standards, it drew a good crowd, just under 14,000 tickets sold. You know, good ratings on Showtime, all that stuff. So it was a successful fight in that sense. And it really launched Cyborg into the national consciousness as far as MMA goes, for sure. However, Carano, for her part, she would never fight again. This would be the end. I actually, doing my research for the covering the Carano versus Cyborg event on the podcast, I noticed that she actually was supposed to fight in 2011 again and wasn't cleared. I don't know any information about that, so I'm gonna try to dig into that once we get to that point in the progression of the podcast. But she, at the age of 27, was done. So what are your thoughts? I mean, Matt, she's just getting into her physical prime. You know, where could she have gone? What are your thoughts on Carano never stepping into MMA again?
Well, it made sense when I heard it from her perspective, because she described being really devastated by losing that fight and just feeling like she didn't put on a good showing and she let a lot of people down. That, you know, the same thing fighters often go through, where you have a whole team that prepares you for the fight and everything, and then afterwards you feel like, well, I'm sorry, guys, like, did I just waste your time by having you help me for this fight? Mm-hmm. And she described dealing with some of that, and that she left San Jose, drove down to San Diego with a friend of hers, and was just kind of gonna lick her wounds down there for a little while. And it was within a couple days that, like, an agent who she said she had previously talked to, who didn't really sound that interested in her, and called up sounding suddenly very, very interested, to say, like, Steven Soderbergh wants to talk to you. See, he wants to meet you. And, you know, he has a movie. And she's had no idea who Steven Soderbergh was at the time, and so she didn't really care. And then the agent was like, you know, reeling off some of his credits, and was like, he did Traffic, the Michael Douglas, Benicio del Toro movie. And she was like, whoa, okay, I love that movie. Like, let me meet with this guy. And I think that part of it, at least, is you're feeling really disappointed coming off of one thing. Somebody else comes to you and says, like, hey, you could do this other thing, which, you know, might pay better, might not involve, you know, you getting punched in the face on TV while people yell at you. It gives you a chance to rebound in a different way. It gives you, like, another version of your life that you could maybe live, instead of thinking, like, how am I going to go get revenge on Cyborg? It feels like if you're depressed in one of those moments, it's got to be one of the two, right? Either you tell yourself you're getting right back in the gym and we're going to train to beat Cyborg, or somebody else offers you something else like that. And I could see how you'd be like, you know what, that sounds pretty good. Let me go try and do that. I also think she mentioned that once she had reached a certain level, it got difficult to just go into a gym and just be part of the team and disappear into that training and not think about anything else, that you had to worry about, who are your training partners? Are they going to be kind of telling tales out of school about you? Because people are going to want to hear about how Gina Carano looks in the gym. If you can light her up in sparring, maybe you go around and you talk about how you just beat up Gina Carano in the gym. Like, you're not going to be able to just live life like any other fighter at that point, you know, which I think a lot of fighters have experienced. And that served as an additional barrier to kind of getting back in, because where do you train? Where do you go where you feel comfortable and you feel like you can trust everybody?
Hmm. Yeah, that's the mental side really seemed to enter into it for her, whether it was being in the cage or out. So that tends to track with that. So looking back at, I mean, Cyborg, you know, gone on to be, you know, basically the greatest female fighter of all time, except for now, maybe Amanda Nunes. But still, you know, I think it'd be hard to not place her as the most important fighter. I mean, she won the, you know, Strikeforce, Invicta, UFC, and Bellator belts. I mean, no one else is come even close to that. But between the two of them, you know, where does this fight now stand in MMA history, not just women's MMA, but MMA history as a whole? And then those two fighters, Carano and Cyborg, where do they stand in MMA history as well?
I think that this was the first fight to show us that women's MMA can produce a sort of mega fight that has that big fight feeling, that it's not just just a territory of the men. And we've seen it now many times since then. And now we don't even think about that question. But at the time, in 2009, I think that there were also always going to be people who were like, oh, you know, women's MMA is a sideshow. And I think Dana White was probably one of those people. Mm-hmm. I think you know, Gina Carano's fight with Julie Kedzie at that Elite XC event back in 2007, that was a big one to kind of show, like, okay, it was a big one for introducing people to women's MMA and getting them interested. This was the first one that felt like there was a huge build, and it was these two sort of titans of the field at the same time, right there in their primes, and they're going to go at it, and we're going to build the entire show around it. But I remember really distinctly before this fight, I was talking to a manager at the time, and we were talking about it, and he was like, you know, Cyborg is just going to crush Gina Carano. And I was like, you know, probably, but Gina Carano, she's a good stand-up fighter. She's a good athlete. If there's somebody who has the kind of skill set that maybe they're going to match up with Chris Cyborg, maybe if she can get through the first round, she could play this game a little bit. And I remember him telling me a story about watching Chris Cyborg cut weight for a previous bout. And he said that she was pretty close, but having a hard time getting the last few pounds off. And what she did was pulled up highlights of her opponent or some YouTube video of her opponent fighting, and then just started to walk around getting mad and like spitting in a cup and just making like angry noises, like as she was watching her and thinking about her. And he was like, I was watching her and I was getting afraid for my safety. And I saw her then and I thought, you know what, whoever has to face this person, you better do it now before she gains any more experience and technical ability, because a few fights from now, she's going to be an absolute monster. And that's pretty much exactly what happened.
Yeah. I'll mention, I'd read an article where they'd interviewed Wanderlei Silva before this Carano Cyborg fight. And Wanderlei was saying, like, you can't, you know, when you train with girls, you tend to try to take it easy, or, you know, you don't go full bores. Like, if you do that with her, she trains with men, she'll knock you out. And just talking about what a terror she was. And I'm like, if Wanderlei is saying that, you know, if Wanderlei is saying that, yeah.
Not easily intimidated, I would think, no, about Wanderlei.
No,
yeah.
No. So, yeah. So that's, it's crazy how well the fight did and how this, again, kind of launched just them in separate careers and, you know, completely separate directions. Which is, and again, you looking back, and I had not realized Gina's 4 months older than me. When I saw, you know, all the unfortunate recent news with the Mandalorian and all that sort of thing, I was like, she's my age. Like, she could have been fighting these last, you know, 12 years if she wanted to, and who knows where she'd be, or, 12 years, who knows where she'd be, you know, at this point as a fighter. But, and I would, you know, they tried to put together, Carano versus Ronda, you know, Ronda Rousey. And I think it was 2014, and Dana sent that unfortunate text to the wrong person. It went to Gina, and that scuttled that, you know, that whole situation, because that could have been another mega fight. And, you know, she's kind of kept her toe in a little bit, but you know, obviously Cyborg's eclipsed her. So I did want to ask about your articles and your podcast. So tell us about what you're doing for The Athletic, and then your podcast is with Chad as well, and where people can find your work if they want to get in touch, find you on social, all that stuff.
Yeah, you can find me over there at The Athletic. Me and Sean Alshadi are the MMA writers over at The Athletic, and trying to churn out good content for people there. And we've also got a subscription sign-up special for people, new subscribers can get in for $1 a month right now. It's just, you know, something to think about. Yeah, I do the Co-Main Event podcast with Chad Dundas. We're at comainevent.com. You can, and wherever you get your podcasts. We do a free Monday podcast each week, but then we also do a ton of other stuff on our Patreon. We have a Wednesday live chat, movie club. Our movie club this week is Free to All, where we discuss Predator, an absolute triumph in film, the 1987 Arnold Schwarzenegger film. Swing by, check us out, patreon.com/comainevent. If you want to check out the movie club and see what else we have to offer there, it's a good time.
All right. Your, Twitter handle?
@ Ben Folks MMA.
Okay. FOWLKES. All right. Awesome. All right. Couple more questions and we'll let you get out of here. But any, just as a, not even necessarily as a journalist, maybe as a fan, but are there any particular moments in Strikeforce that stand out to you, whether inside the cage or outside of the cage, anything that really just jumps out in your mind when you think of Strikeforce?
Yeah. Well, when I think of it, especially as a journalist who went out and covered quite a few Strikeforce events, they always had a certain kind of feel, and it was a different feel than going to UFC events. Like, the UFC really quickly became this well-oiled machine where it was going to be the same sort of every time. And they really tightly controlled during fight week. Here's what days the press conferences and then workouts and then there's weigh-ins, and they really controlled where you went, what you saw. And you had to really try hard as a journalist to break out of that and get to cover anything else other than what everybody else was doing. And Strikeforce events were always just a little bit different. And especially it felt like, okay, you're always in San Jose. They're at the old HP Pavilion. They changed the name now. I can't remember. Is it the SAP Center now?
SAP Center, yeah.
Yeah. But and, you know, everybody would be staying at the same downtown San Jose hotels. You'd go to, like, Original Famous Rays or whatever the Italian joint
Original Joe's.
That's it. Where the waiters are all in tuxedos and stuff. And, and you just, you know, you could just post up there, eat a meatball and drink a wine and watch as, like, all these MMA people come through one at a time through the night and everybody's there. And Strikeforce events just always kind of had that different sort of feel to them. And now the SAP Center, but the HP Pavilion before, it was a fun place to see fights, and they would get good crowds in there, and they built up a really good local fan base that knew to look what kind of a show to expect from them, and really got into the fighters that they had. And especially when it seemed like Strikeforce hit a point where it was like, okay, we're going to make a play for some of these big free agents, you know, guys like Fedor and stuff like that. And it felt like this, the attention to the events jumped up a notch or two. And I remember watching Fedor walk out the night where he lost to Fabricio Werdum, you know, and he's walking
broke
out
my
there.
Broke my heart that night.
The Russian music is playing, everything, you know, and you're thinking, like, okay, I remember Fabricio Werdum all that week had just been, you'd see him in the hotel and he was constantly, it seemed, just screwing around. Like, him and his cornermen, his coaches, they were just like literally playing grab ass in the lobby and running around. You're like, does this guy know he's going to get wrecked by Fedor, the unbeatable Russian destroying machine at the end of this week? And then he went out there and beat him. And the my favorite thing about it was afterwards, you could see him. He partied the way I would party if I somehow magically beat Fedor, you know? Like, he didn't just be like, hey, I'm gonna act like I've been there before, no big deal, just another fight. Like, he partied like he had been named king of the world, and it was awesome. It was great to see.
I mean, it's not a great memory for me. I was there, and I'm just such a huge Fedor fan. I remember standing and putting my hands over my face on this, like, I think I was in the media section that night, and just stood up. It's like, oh my God, what just happened? And just like I called it like a hushed roar that went over, you know, the crowd, like, just like, it was like, what just happened? And then, right here in the reaction.
Well, it was like one of those finishes where it seemed like it almost looked like he dropped Fabricio. I think he kind of slipped more trying to avoid the punch. Yeah. And then Fedor followed him down there. And it was like, okay, you're going to throw up a triangle off your back on Fedor, I guess. Yeah, like, oh, sure.
How many guys have tried to do that and he just slipped out and just like pasted them with right hands?
Yeah. And but then there's just a moment where you go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. He might be in trouble. Wait a minute. And
his
then
head's turning bright red. No. But this is Fedor. I remember seeing his head turning bright red. And I'm like, no. This is Fedor. Anybody else, I'd be like, oh, this is done. But I'm like, no, this is Fedor. And he will get out of this. So,
yeah. And he had been in those sort of little moments before where you'd be like, oh, it looks like he's in a little bit of trouble. But then he always got out, always was fine, always won. And so it didn't seem like it was going to be anything until suddenly you see him tap. And it was just like, oh my God, I can't believe that actually happened.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, Fabricio Werdum is backstage partying with Forrest Whitaker.
I didn't even know he was there. That's awesome.
No, you can find the pictures if you Google. Like, okay, it's like Fabricio Werdum and a team of Brazilians are all like jumping up and down, singing songs and yelling and celebrating. And Forrest Whitaker is standing in the middle of them with a look on his face like, I don't even know how I got here.
That's awesome. Well, those shows were fun. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Is I always had a good time. I went to tons of Strikeforce events, pretty much everyone that was in San Jose since I lived there, and then worked for the company for a while. And they were always so much fun. I love doing. I miss the promotion. So with that in mind, final question. We'll let you go. What is Strikeforce's place in MMA history as a promotion? Where do they stand?
You know, it's weird. As more time goes by, I wonder if we'll remember it as a certain kind of MMA of a time period, like sort of the way that we think of Affliction, where it's like, oh man, not just the show, but the shirts. And you think of it as like, that was a snapshot of like a thing that we were doing.
Real quick, I saw Josh Thompson shared a picture on Twitter of him and Fitch and Koscheck and I want to say Kane, all in like that style, that old Affliction Extreme Couture, you know, from like 2009 or whatever. And I was just like, God, what a snapshot of just how nasty. Like, yeah, everybody had those. But yeah, anyway, sorry, go ahead. But yeah, I remember that.
Just t-shirts that look like they're going to set off a metal detector. You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, Strikeforce was around for much longer and was less of like a one blip in time kind of a thing. And yet it was also, the more time we get away from it, the more it seems like it was like of a time. I remember that 2009, 2010, 11 sort of Strikeforce time. And I don't know, it makes you wonder, will we look back on it as here's what it was before the UFC got such a unshakable stranglehold on it? It's hard now not to look back on it and see it as a precursor to what some of the stuff that Scott Coker is doing with Bellator now. It's hard to really kind of sum it up, but at the time, especially coming up in California, and it was one of those where it was like trying to prove, you know what, yeah, you have a home base that you can operate out of. You might go to a few other cities, but you're right here in California. You kind of born here and you've built up a local audience here, fighters that a lot of fighters who came out of that area and everything. And it just felt like a very unique thing that you maybe couldn't happen now. Maybe you wouldn't see the same thing be able to arise out of the current MMA landscape.
Yeah, it feels like the sport maybe has grown up too much, you know, for that type of promotion at this point.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But I just Google Fabricio and Forrest, and there's a really cool picture of Forrest, like you said, surrounded by all these Brazilians, and he's kind of smiling. He definitely sticks out comparison to all the guys he's surrounded by.
So. Well, I remember too, sitting in that press conference, and Fedor, you know, showed up to the press conference and was answering questions and was, you know, being a real sportsman about it. And they had to keep stepping out in the hallway to ask Fabricio and his team to quiet down. They're singing songs and making all kinds of noise. And it's like, yeah, they are not in a quieting down kind of mood. You
know? Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ben, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. You tell Chad that if I don't like his book, I'm coming for my dollar, though. So just
make sure, fair enough.
But appreciate you taking the time to be on Inside the Hexagon, and best of luck. And fans, make sure you go check out the Co-Main Event podcast as well as Ben's writing on The Athletic. But thanks again, Ben.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, Ben Foulkes, for taking the time to join us on the show today. It was great connecting with him, talking about Carano versus Cyborg, breaking down the historical significance for both women's MMA and MMA overall, talking about the aftermath for both fighters. So make sure that you check out his writings for The Athletic, as well as his podcast, The Co-Main Event Podcast, alongside Chad Dundas, another great MMA journalist. So make sure you check all of that out. Also, make sure you check out our upcoming episodes. We are going to, in our next event episode, be covering the Strikeforce debut for the heavyweight GOAT, Fedor Emelianenko. He takes on Brett Rogers. It is Strikeforce, Fedor versus Rogers. I'm excited to cover this. Gegard Mousasi is on the card. Fabricio Werdum is back. We also see the Strikeforce debut of Antonio Bigfoot Silva, who would later take on Fedor as well. And then the co-main event features Jake Shields taking on Jason Mayhem Miller for the vacant Strikeforce middleweight title. This is an action-packed card. I can't wait to cover it. That's going to be a lot of fun. What is also going to be a lot of fun is some of the upcoming interview guests that we've got. No names to reveal at the moment because we're still getting things locked down, but we've got some cool stuff coming up. And speaking of cool stuff, make sure you check us out on social media. You can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at The Hexagon Pod. And you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. I would love to hear from you. And then also, we are going to be joining the Evergreen Podcast Network. I am really excited about this. This is a great group of shows, great people behind the scenes. So there's going to be more information on that coming up. Nothing's really going to change other than just the quality of the show overall. I think it's going to help raise things, and I think you're going to enjoy what we're doing even more so. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Running should be simple. Just put on your shoes and go. And yet, when you try to learn about how to get better at it, especially as you age, you're confronted with conflicting advice, complicated workouts, and confusing nutrition trends that just won't work for you. On The Planted Runner, I'll share exactly how to run faster, longer, and feel great doing it at any age because you don't have time to waste. I'm Coach Claire Bartholik, and I went from not running at all in my late 30s to finishing a marathon in 2:58 at age 42, all on a plant-based diet. I've helped hundreds of runners achieve new personal records well into their 60s and even 70s with science-backed training, plant-based nutrition, and proven mental strength techniques. Each episode of The Planted Runner is like a private coaching session on the run where you'll learn from me and the guests I interview. You'll get actionable lessons to help you become a better runner every week and reach goals you never thought possible. Whether you're training for your first 5K or your 50th marathon, take along The Planted Runner on your next run. Let me show you how your best running is still ahead of you.